You're listening to the Digital Void Podcast, where we explore digital culture, media, technology, and memes, featuring critical and empowering conversations with experts at the forefront of our digital moment. My name is Josh Chapdelaine, and my co-host is Dr. Jamie Cohen. In a creator economy where revenue models are largely determined by subscriptions, how can creators avoid being creatively trapped by audiences they've worked to build? Where is there room for creators to take risks? On today's episode, it's my pleasure to welcome the Webby Award-nominated zine writer, Matt Klein, to discuss his first ever printed edition of zine, titled Audience Capture. Klein explains the social theory driving this phenomenon, what happens when it's taken to its extreme, and how to resist falling into a creative trap. Ultimately, Klein's work is focused on empowering people to realize their creative potential and not feel stuck by the rigid conditions of our digital moment. And it's a privilege to have this conversation with him. You can pre-order physical copies of Audience Capture now. I've provided a link in this week's show notes. Before we begin, we're only a few weeks away from our first festival of the year, the premiere of Memes, Myths, and Magic on Saturday, April 29th at Caveat in New York City. We're bringing together an unbelievable speaker lineup featuring artists, comedians, and journalists to explore how memes, myths, and magic are central in our lives. From live AI ethics demos to talks from Abby Govindan, C.T. Jones and Moises Mendez II, Kelsey Weekman, Ryan Broderick, Jamie Cohen, Alex Petros, and Morris Coleman, this will be a festival that will challenge you, make you laugh, learn, and ultimately reveal the ways that memes, myths, and magic influence our lives in unexpected ways. Tickets are on sale now for only $18 in advance and $5 to tune in via live stream. Now, here's this week's conversation with zine writer Matt Klein. For the last several months, you've been speaking to me about this concept of audience capture that I've been really captivated by and delighted in exploring and reading through this wonderful printed version of a zine that has just been released. So congratulations on the printed version. We're leading off the conversation with audience capture. And so this sounds almost violent in nature, right? You're capturing your audience. But Matt, what do you mean when we say audience capture?
Yeah, ironically, it doesn't have a great phrase or name or coinage of what's happening here. And I thought about changing it, but enough people were already using the phrase audience capture. I'm like, let me just keep this one going. Yeah, it is violent and in nature. And I think it just speaks to the power of what's happening here. To kind of like break it down, maybe we'll take one step back, which is for the longest time, we've always viewed the interaction between a creator and an audience as one, as the creator doing something to the masses, right? Did the song move you? Did the speech change your thinking? The creator was the agent, the one that it's doing. Audience capture is the inverse of that relationship. What an audience can do to a creator, particularly in the negative realm, where an audience hypnotizes or captures a creator based upon just their mere presence or imagined presence. So the quintessential example is how online audiences today are staring at us and we're feeling not just dependent upon them for many things to affirm our existence or status or worth, etc. But further, audiences deriving what we actually create in the first place and what we put out into the world. So I was really interested in exploring that inverse of just the creator-audience relationship, but through the negative realm.
And so this specific type of creation that you're referring to spans genres. It is musicians, it is writers, it is vloggers, it's VTubers, streamers, everything. So what is the existential threat here? How is the self or our self at risk in this model of audience capture?
When we think about creators, we typically think of the musician, the celebrity, the athlete, the one that's in the public eye with the spotlight on them. And what I wanted to call attention to is that we're all creators. The creator economy is a horrific phrase in itself, but we're all putting out content. And content is its own nebulous term, but we're all just contributing to culture in some ways, whether that be a LinkedIn post, whether that be our own song, whether that be our own TikTok or our own post or review, or it could be a comment on someone else's story. That is still a piece of content in which we are putting ourselves out there to be viewed by others. So this idea of audience capture applies to everyone and to all pieces of content on the internet. And it sounds quite unwieldy because it is. And just thinking about what we reply to or like how we react to someone's story, right? Is it this emoji or that emoji? How will they think of us based upon what we shared with them? That's an example of audience capture. We are being captured by the one that we're trying to serve. And to me, that's this really fascinating play because, again, it applies to everyone. And it's happening in this kind of omnipresent kind of atmosphere environment, and we're not really paying a lot of attention to it. We're feeling it, but we're not calling it out.
So this feeling that you're experiencing, as I was reading through Zine, I was struck by something you wrote at the end, which I have known for a long time, but was surprised that you shared with the world. And that is, as someone who studies, writes, and works in social media trends as a career, the line that stuck out in particular is that you aren't on many platforms. You're not on BeReal, you're not on Instagram, you're not on TikTok. So as a creator, in the sense that it is a nebulous term, but you are the writer of Zine and you do post on one or two social media platforms. How do you keep a bird's eye view without participating? How do you feel this sensibility? And is it hard to gain and understand this fluency if you're not participating?
It's a horrific relationship. I mean, I compare it to like the Apple execs who wouldn't give their kids the iPads because they know what's happening, right? And I feel the same regarding some of these platforms, right? I'm not on Facebook, I'm not on Instagram, so on and so forth, because I'm so attuned to that feeling of audience capture. I don't like performing. That was my dissertation of Goffman and understanding the presentation of self. And I'm so conscious of it. And I think it's so unfortunate that we're at a moment where the only way you could beat it is by opting out. And I think that just speaks to our inability to balance right now, or perhaps the lack of tools or features that allow us to kind of control this experience. It's a really tough relationship. I mean, it's really hard. And as a creator myself with Zine and in my writing, right, that consciousness is kind of dialed up and I'm hyper aware of it. And it's tough, right? Because it's so meta and I coincidentally deal with so many meta things. I'm just fascinated with the kind of the zoomed out systems of the systems. But right, even putting out and publishing this Zine on audience capture, I'm feeling the pressures of it, right? I'm rereading the LinkedIn update. I'm rereading the release. How is this going to be viewed by the thousands of people? Is this the right price? What will people think of me if this is too high? So on and so forth. And it sounds like a really superficial example because it's just right, a sample size of one in a single piece of writing published. But again, my point that I'm trying to make is that this experience is being felt by so many people and there's detriments to our mental health, whether or not we're conscious of its effects on us. It's playing out kind of as this undercurrent to all of our online social interactions.
Right. So the features of social media are biased toward a certain sense of performativity. You mentioned Goffman and presentation. For those who aren't super familiar with Goffman listening to this podcast, can you dive into a little bit of his theory to help distill it?
Absolutely. The long short is that we're each on a stage, that our lives are as performers, whether we like it or not. We wear different masks based upon the audience that is in front of us, and we perform for them. And it sounds like this really negative thing, right? Where we're manipulating our identity and performance. But it's quite natural, right? Who I am to my colleagues is different than who I am to my parents, than who I am to my partner, than who I am to the barista at the coffee shop, right? We change our language, we change our clothing, right? If I'm out at a dinner versus am I at a funeral, right? We're performing based upon various pieces of context. What I'm calling attention to and how this relates to audience capture is that our performances are immortal. The pieces of content we put online, for the most part, are stuck in time. So in other words, we're performing 24/7. The stage lights never dim in regards to Goffman's stage. And then further, our audience is larger than we could ever possibly imagine. We're dealing with an international audience, and not just those who bought tickets, but everyone on the street, right? Because it's those who didn't even opt in or we didn't even invite to the performance that are judging us. So the scale of this presentation of self or this audience capture phenomenon is much larger than we've ever really imagined or signed up for.
Right. And it's different than historical technologies or mediums, right? Because if the printing press allowed text to be disseminated and copied in mass, and the telegram allowed for information to travel distances that were unfathomable previous to it, we finally see the rise of those two technologies combined to create the penny presses and the newspapers, and the image and text combined help to create an entirely new media environment. But the difference with this is that almost everyone in the West has access to a smart device or internet. And like you said, there are people who pay for access, but then there are spectators. And so it is a new paradigm. And so that performativity is informing not just our content, but our actual lived selves.
The one thing I'll add in that too is that everyone's also a critic, right? Everyone else now has a say on the content in which we put out there. And one of the strategies that I put forth is to recognize that accepting and rejecting audience feedback is not a binary, right? Not everything has to be considered and integrated, nor should it all be ignored or, you know, ridiculed back. And deciding how we interpret feedback, whether it's explicit or implicit, right? Imagined, it's really this choose your own adventure. And what I'm trying to do is trying to shine light on, again, this phenomenon, but also empower people to recognize that, like, hey, I don't have to be beholden to this audience, right? I could maintain my artistic integrity and decide what gets interpreted and what gets ignored.
It's interesting that you can maintain your integrity by leaning into a niche, as you discuss in audience capture. The thing I wanted to play with a little bit is the idea that you can simultaneously become the expert of a niche at the same time that you want to maintain your integrity and creative expression. There is a huge tension between those two. Personally, I almost never share personal intimate details on this podcast. This might be the first time I'm doing it, but about a decade ago, I was writing almost exclusively about baseball. And at that time, I decided to begin to make a shift away from writing about baseball to thinking and creating about tech, media, society, and culture. And the backlash I got on social media platforms, stick in your lane, only write about baseball. It was intense. And I mean, I'm saying intense. It was probably only a few comments in all actuality, but it stuck with me as like—
But it was intense to you.
Right.
And that's real.
Right. As a 21-year-old creator at the time, I was thinking to myself, wow, maybe I do have a lane. Maybe I shouldn't have that opinion. And I'm sure you as a creator, you experience that catch-22 as well.
Totally. And it's tough, right? And I think there's another part to this too, right? I mean, I started Zine as just a publication or newsletter just to share with friends and family, right? They can receive the email as soon as I publish something new. I'm like, yeah, I'll be happy if I get 20, 30 people of close family and friends where I don't have to just, you know, send them individual links via texts. And right, fast forward, there's tens of thousands of people now reading this thing. And I was trying to escape audience capture, but audience capture has still found its way back to me. And it's hard, right? Building for niche and then finally an audience forming around it. And then how do you double down on that specialty and not let that newfound audience persuade you in a certain direction? I don't have all the answers. I've tried to outline some strategies. I mean, but it's a new experience and we're all trying to figure this out as we go along.
I'm reminded of the attempted genre switch of Linkin Park in the late aughts when they became very famous for recording songs like Numb and releasing albums like Meteora. And they tried to change their sound from a heavier rock genre to basically electronic synth music. I remember they had a hardcore fan base that pushed back pretty intensely against the attempted genre switch. But I'm curious, from your perspective, that experience happened in a pre-social media environment or at the perhaps birth of Facebook. So how would you compare the current creator crisis of audience capture to that dilemma?
Oh, I love that one. I mean, I don't know how different it is. Maybe it's perhaps just the scale or the pressure or all that pile on, and maybe the implications of it as well, right? This is happening at an individual scale in ways that it perhaps wasn't before, now that everyone has direct access to creators. And then further, as entertainment becomes more quote unquote participatory, there's this newfound expectation that directors or artists have to integrate the feedback of audiences. And on one hand, that's incredibly refreshing and exciting, right? Co-authoring IP with those that you're trying to go after is great, right? You're folding them in and you're fostering fandom. That's awesome. But at the same time, the audience doesn't know what they want. You have to remember, like, that's an incredible just reminder from Rick Rubin. But then we watch kind of, I'm going to eat my own words and kind of go in the other direction. We see the implications when we forget that the audience doesn't know what they want. We see audience capture happen on not just an artistic scale, but within our news publications as well, whether that be the Fox or the MSNBCs, et cetera. And without really going too political, maybe we just keep it at this high level. That's an extremist tendency of audience capture at scale, where outlets are feeding audiences what they want to see. And we see this loss of integrity, and we see the implications of what happens when we lose that integrity. Granted, right, political and extreme example, but this is happening on much smaller scales as well, which for individuals, and to your point, are still harmful.
They are harmful. I want to press you on something that you said, because I want to prevent a deluge of emails that will contribute to some potential paralysis. When you say the audience doesn't know what they want, are you saying that as a consumer, they're not aware of what they hope to experience? Or can you unpack that for me?
Yeah, I mean it in more just a, and this is going back to, right, Henry Ford. And I think maybe I'll explain the quote, right? Which he asked himself, well, if I asked people what they wanted, they would just say a faster horse. They wouldn't say a car, because the car didn't actually exist yet. People don't know what's possible. So when I say an audience doesn't know what they want, yes, they have their own preferences and attitudes and styles, and that informs culture. And that, again, is incredibly important if I go back to the importance of fandom and, you know, being respectful and folding in, again, those attitudes, opinions, etc. We also have to recognize that creators and artists have power. They have power to create net new pieces of work. They're creative in nature. That's all of us. We're all creative in nature. We all have that opportunity. But what I specifically mean is that we should have the microphone in the hands of the creator and let them hold on to that longer than passing it off to the audience, because the audience themselves, yes, they may have opinions, but they don't know what the creator is capable of. And the last thing we want is for the audience to stifle or to control, right, audience capture or capture the creator.
Right. So you're not saying that the audience has no autonomy or agency. You're saying that the audience is seeking a specific experience or hoping for a specific experience, and the audience should trust creators to deliver that experience and create some sort of symbiotic relationship that empowers creators rather than diminishes the relationship.
Exactly right. I mean, it's a balance. We're just the blanket statement here is, like, it's a balance, and we're trying to empower creators to recognize, I still have authority. I still have say over what I want to express. The market may say, that's a horrific idea, we don't like it. And then, you know, fair game to audiences for letting that person know that, like, hey, we don't like this piece of music, we don't like this film. That's important too, right? Because you're making for the audience. I think the point being is that we have to acknowledge that it goes both ways. And in a moment where it feels as if the audience has so much power, maybe we just, you know, try to tip the scales a little bit more towards the middle and empower creators to say, hey, wait, I've got something to say. Maybe the audience doesn't know exactly what I'm capable of or what I want to produce. Let me hold on to that bit and maybe dial that up a little more.
I'd love to get back to this as you provide strategies to resist audience capture in a little bit. So I'm going to put a bookmark on this for now, but I would love to dive into some potential positive examples of how fandom reactions can influence corporations and creators, but also the dark side. One that was very amusing to me and has always been is the Sonic the Hedgehog design being forced to change. There's another example of a 14-year-old's plea to Weezer to cover a popular song that also influences the band to record that song. What are some of the positive examples of this type of feedback? What are the negative examples? And ultimately, how can this become grim?
So we'll hit the positive ones. I mean, those two are really interesting. And for some people, they could be interpreted as negatives as well, right? That studios or artists have sold out to audiences. And I think that, again, speaks of the balance, right? There's no right or wrong answer here. I go back to fandom and communities. And I think that's just a net positive that we really haven't experienced before. I mean, fandom is one of the most powerful dynamics that's happening in culture right now, where audiences are having a direct line of communication with studios through online conversations, saying this is what we like and this is what we don't like. And that's the cheat code for what, you know, producers that ultimately put out into culture. That's great. That's incredibly powerful because that work then becomes more resonant, more representative, more diverse. We could go back to brands, right? That could be more sustainable, more mindful, more ethically sourced, et cetera, right? So there's upside to audiences controlling corporations or brands, et cetera. The downside is when we don't have healthy skepticism or distance and the mobs run amok and have this parasitic relationship. There are plenty of influencers without naming names, and we could use our own imaginations, keep it as a Rorschach test, where audiences have formed around individuals, and those influencers have then decided, okay, well, at least I have an audience now. I'll let them represent me and represent my opinions, even though those influencers or media personalities may not have actually cared about those things or wanted those people in the first place. And that then becomes a little bit of toxic, or rather a toxic relationship. Again, we're speaking in kind of ambiguous, nebulous terms here, but I think audience capture can take on a parasitic relationship if a creator is not mindful of, again, right, their own autonomy and agency, and not mindful of how they're being hypnotized by metrics or a crowd forming at their feet.
When I was reading that piece and listening to your explanation about the crowd forming at your feet based on certain beliefs or values, I can't help but think, well, first, let me preface this by saying I'm very glad that you mentioned human agency and autonomy, right? Because creators, after working to develop themselves and define themselves as an expert in a particular niche, creating content, growing a following, and developing an audience that has grown to trust a creator to be both a creator that will adhere to their standards and perhaps also challenge them, but also stick to something comfortable, right? After a long time, people continue to return to Oreo, not because it's the best cookie per se, but because it's familiar. And whether you buy it in New York or California, you'll have consistency. So media personalities, creators, etc., eventually develop this brand. But should we be discussing kayfabe or the on-screen persona reality popularized by professional wrestling or sports entertainment in this country more deeply in this context? Again, we can play Rorschach test with any specific media personality or figure, but if I started to develop extremist beliefs, or if my followers were exhibiting or espousing extremist beliefs, to me, I would challenge myself to wonder why I was attracting that type of crowd. I wouldn't have the sensation that I needed to lean into that to serve that audience. My instinct would be to step back. So what is the role of human autonomy and agency? And to what degree does audience capture, or rather, do you believe audience capture eventually leans into some performers or creators developing something resembling a kayfabe character?
I mean, that's absolutely happening. I mean, we're seeing it, and we'll keep it high level. You know what? I'll keep this one actually short because I don't think it really requires a lengthy explanation or answer here. I think calling attention to audience capture is an invitation for self-examination, right? For as long as one is looking at the mirror and questioning, who am I attracting? Is this an audience I like or don't like? That's great. That's just step one. I mean, that's all we need. And that's as really at the bare minimum what we're trying to do here. Am I mindful of who I'm trying to go after and who's forming? Do I like this or not? And there doesn't have to be a right or wrong answer. But for as long as we're slowing down and approaching our content and our performances mindfully and slowly, I think that's table stakes. That's really all I see as really important as a critical step one.
I think it's an important step one, to be sure. I would also love to know, ultimately, how do we resist this? I love that you dedicated an entire section of the zine to this, because it's so easy to diagnose a cultural phenomenon or a trend or a problem. It's far less easy to have rules or values that can help you escape. I know that you developed 10 consistent with the commandments, and I would love to begin to dive into some of your suggestions for creators who are really struggling with this tension and are hoping to find pathways to escape.
So I'll start with just the first one, because I think it's the most important. Attentions, views, and fame will never satisfy. You ask celebrities, you ask artists, you ask YouTubers, you look at what happened to Emma Chamberlain, right? They're not happy. They're not any happier.
What happened to Emma Chamberlain for our audience that may or may not know?
It's a YouTuber who amassed millions and millions of views and countless partnerships and was the case study of, right, Gen Z influencer fame. And she burned out. It wasn't happy. It didn't check a lot of boxes. And it was anxiety provoking. And we're all on these paths of trying to amass more and more eyeballs and followers and views and sponsorships and partnerships. As soon as we reach it, we're not any happier. And I felt that way personally on a much smaller scale with Zine. Yes, it's nice that there are tens of thousands more people reading my work. Am I a happier person? Not necessarily, because happiness comes from other things beyond metrics, which brings us to another one, right? Where numbers lie and are this hedonistic treadmill, right? We could be fighting for a million views on something, but we forget that numbers are infinite. What's after a million is a million and one. We're never satisfied. They just keep on going and going and going. And the question there is like, what is the worth of a follow or the value of a view? Would you rather have 1,000 readers who won't share your work, or 10 readers who will sing your praises from, you know, the top of the mountain, or maybe just one reader who's willing to actually pay you for your work? And we forget that there's different dynamics or weights to these metrics, and we're only measuring the things that we could, or rather, let's put it this way, we only care about the things that we could actually measure, and it's hard to measure things that actually matter. So we're on this treadmill of chasing things that don't actually matter at the end of the day. So those are two kind of the biggest. I think the other one that I'll throw in there is just to embrace some silence and friction. The hypnotism of audience capture is that we're trying to get a reaction. And we found, and maybe this ties a few things together when we were talking ambiguously about various influencers, an engagement feels good because it's, you know, it's that hit of dopamine, it's that notification, but it also affirms our existence. And that's a really dangerous path or a slippery slope. One of the solutions here is just to embrace some silence and friction, right? Look around. Can you find anyone else doing what you're doing? And if not, good. That means you're doing something right and that it's new and that you found this white space. I mean, I once cringed when I got an unsubscription notification from my newsletter, but today I embrace it. Good. It means I'm doing something that's differentiated that doesn't work for some people, and I'm pushing people away. That's great. I'm on a right path, but it's hard to hold that when we're in a culture where hockey stick growth is the norm. That's unsustainable. And I'd much rather write for fewer people who actually care about my work than a million people. Because if I have a million people as an audience, that means I'm diluting work and my work isn't actually for anybody, but rather the common denominator. And that's not a game I want to play.
It's a zero-sum game. And that directly ties into the money trap, which I have a question about. And you write, feedback is harder to ignore when the audience is paying you. But if money is a trap, how does a creator weigh this, right? Because if I have one person or one donor on Substack that's paying me $50,000 and I have zero other subscribers, then I'm effectively relying on one person. But one of the benefits of this economy is I can have 10,000 people paying me $5. So if I'm a creator, how do I weigh feedback if there is that type of scale?
I'm not even going to pretend I know that answer, because I don't. And I think within that answer is the reality and the truth that it's so contextual. It's so dependent upon the individual, right? Every creator has their own intent and goals and mission and path. And let's just leave it at that. I mean, everyone's in different financial circumstances as well. And we have to validate that as another point. It is messy. I mean, just plain and simple, it's really messy. charging for this literal physical zine about audience capture, again, incredibly meta, was a really tough exercise. Again, is this too much? Is this too little? What about those who can't necessarily afford? How do I reserve copies for those who are requesting and don't have the financial means at the time? These are all things I'm really mindful of. If I could do it again, would I do it any differently? I don't know. But what I'm happy about, and I'm, this is again, a meta exercise that I'm most proud of, is that at least I'm having this conversation and at least I'm thinking about it with others. And we're having this conversation right now. Again, that's step one. Are we living this examined life as creators in this weird, weird, weird moment? For as long as we're just talking about it, that's, again, that's table stakes. We could figure out the rest later, but we gotta nail this one first.
I think that you're well on your way. I have two more questions about this. So number 10, your final commandment or your final recommendation is care more about others and less about yourself, which is such an important value, right? Care about others, have empathy. But as a creator, that is the same tension that allows you to ingest that feedback.
Exactly. It's a paradox. It's a complete paradox. And I land on this one because it almost undermines everything and it just kind of blows up everything. But what I mean by that, right, where you care more about others than yourself, is an exercise in recognizing that this entire thing is just ego. And ego is the demise of any creator, any celebrity, any artist. We have plenty of case studies here, and that it's an ever-present trap. And the only way we remove ourselves from that dynamic is caring more about others, but not caring more about others in regards to what they want, but just selflessly caring about others. It's opting out of performance, but more in this realm of just charitable giving or community and selflessness and just planting the seeds and giving back in a way that doesn't go back to metrics and doesn't go back to self-worth. And that to me is kind of the final point, that there's this irony, but caring about others doesn't mean caring about others and then relating it back to yourself.
And so my final question for you today is a question that we've been asking every guest at the end of our conversations. And that is, what does a better social media future look like to you? And how do we get there? As someone who's thinking deeply and working on this every single day, what are the things that will help humans in these spaces?
It's mindfulness. It's self-examination. Are we pausing before we post? Are we looking in the mirror about what we've shared or how we've interacted with others? That premium friction, and again, the essence of audience capture and all this work, is just to pump the brakes and add some speed bumps in how we approach our dynamics online. And for as long as we're intentional, I think we're on a right track. And for those that are not, how do we reach out rather than push away those individuals?
Thank you so much. I could not agree more with that. How can people keep up with you, find you, misinterpret what you said about the audience, doesn't know what they want, etc.?
Yes, you can reach me at KleinKleinKlein.com or at KleinKleinKlein on Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And all of my writing can be found at zine.KleinKleinKlein.com. And I'll add that I respect the audience. The audience is very intelligent. And thank you for listening, audience.
And thank you so much for joining. We'll have show notes of everything that Klein said about where to find him, as well as other show notes, including where to purchase your print edition of Zine, in the show notes. Any closing thoughts or words?
Thanks for having me, Josh. I love these conversations. I like the pause. I like slowing down, and I love diving deep because it's all moving so fast right now. And for as long as we're having these conversations, I'm optimistic of where we head next.
And I am optimistic with you. Until next time, thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks again to Klein for taking the time to discuss audience capture. You can find out more about Klein and vote for Zine in this year's Webby Awards in this week's show notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll be back next week.